This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. We're also online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Siblings behaving badly. Concept for a reality TV show? Topic for a TV talk show? Well, in the case of these siblings that we're going to talk about this afternoon, the proper television venue for this story might be Masterpiece Theater. These siblings behaving badly were the younger brothers and sisters of King George III. So on the program today, we're going to take a look at this 18th century royal family drama and its impact on George III and how he handled his rebellious subjects across the Atlantic. Our guest is historian Stella Tillyard. She is the author most recently of A Royal Affair, George III and His Scandalous Siblings. Stella Tillyard says the king saw the American colonists as his family, and that may explain why George resolutely resisted giving up on America and fought the colonists' war of independence for so long. He attempted to rule the Americans as he had attempted to rule his siblings. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments this afternoon. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Stella Tillyard is the author of four previous books, including Aristocrats, Carolyn, Emily, Louisa, and Sarah Lennox, 1740 to 1832. A graduate of Oxford, she has taught at Harvard and UCLA. Her new book, A Royal Affair, is published by Random House. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Stella Tillyard, good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Celeste.
How are you?
I'm very well. We're here in London. It's the end of a beautiful spring day.
We have a lovely spring day here as well. You know, right from the outset of your book, readers get a sense of the tensions in the family, in this family, in terms of their lives being both political and personal, and their lives being both private and public. Was this something the royal family had not had to deal with prior to the reign of George III?
Well, I think perhaps I should just start by talking a bit about how I became interested in this particular tension between public and private life.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had written previously in my book Aristocrats really about four sisters whose very private lives made little public impact, although they were very turbulent. And I began to start to think about the question another way. Are there times in history when private life really does have an impact on public life? And of course, after 1680, when the unwritten British constitution was really framed, supposedly the private life of the monarch could not drift over into public affairs, that the divisions were never hard and fast, so that the royal family in Britain had some kind of private existence notionally, but in fact everything that members of the royal family did could have public impact. I think what began to happen in the 18th century, and particularly with the generation of George III, the siblings and the king born in the 1730s, was that their public life became the subject of professional press and therefore public interest. So it was no longer possible to keep their public life away from their subjects, nor their private life. These things both were pushed into the public domain and became a subject for debate, so that the boundaries became even more blurred at that point. And that was something that I became interested in, to think, how can we write and think about that and about history in the light of that?
Yeah. Is this the dawning of modern celebrity?
It's very much the moment when in Britain, and I think Britain is the first country in the world when what we think of as a celebrity culture is when and where it is developed. And already, I think, at the end of the 17th century, there were so-called secret histories, which were stories that circulated about the scandalous Stuart courts. But what began to happen in the 18th century, from the 1730s onwards, is that the stories of what was going on, as it were, behind closed doors in the royal palaces, began to be leak out as it was happening. And by the 1750s and 1760s, it was very, very difficult to keep anything out of the press. Indeed, people who wanted to become famous started to put things in the press. So scandal became a way of increasing your reputation and public profile. So the kind of relationships that we're very familiar with today between the, in this case, the royal family, but in other cases, other kinds of famous people, and the press, and the reading public, were really cemented, I think, around the royal family in Britain in the 1730s, and then were kind of ratcheted up in the 1750s and 60s to create a culture of celebrity which is, in uncanny ways, similar to that which we know today.
Yeah.
So all these events, which I'm writing about in A Royal Affair, are played out not only in the private lives of the individuals, in their public ramifications, but also in the nation's newspapers, day after day after day, you could read all about it, and nothing was held back. It's there really was a kind of freedom about writing about personal lives, as long as you observed one or two little conventions, that would be astonishing to any celebrity today.
Yeah. Now, the journalists of the day, you note, were newly confident. Why?
They were confident that they could get away with it, if you like, because at the end of the 1750s and in the 1760s, the Crown actually tried to squash down on what could be reported and on printers and so on. And on the whole, juries would refuse to convict. And so that de facto, there became extra layers of freedom were added to the freedoms that the press already enjoyed. And as long as, if you wanted to write about the King, for instance, there was a convention, and you wrote a capital D dash, capital P dash, which stood for a great personage. And every single newspaper reader in the country, or those who to whom the newspapers were read, would know that that meant the King. And or you could write, for him, one of his younger brothers, you could write the D dash, C dash, and that meant the Duke of Cumberland, and everybody knew. So as long as you did that, then there was no grounds for prosecution. It was all played out day by day in the newspapers.
Yeah. Well, tell us about a couple of the things we would have read about George and his siblings in the newspapers of the day.
I think the most exciting and scandalous story that I write about in my book is the story of the King's brother, the Duke of Cumberland, who's involved in a farcical, almost, adultery saga when he begins an affair with one of the wife of one of his best friends, the Earl Grosvenor. And very soon, obviously, London is very small, society is small, people's coaches are recognized in the same way that I remember when I was living in Los Angeles and you'd drive through Beverly Hills and my daughter, who'd be one or two years old at the time, would sort of spot, you know, big cars and say, you know, Rolls-Royce. It's exactly the same way in London in the 18th century. Everyone knew whose coach was who. It would have their livery on the outside. Famous people were followed by members of the public who then took their stories to the press and were paid for them. So that this affair that the King's younger brother carried on was played out in this very small, very permeable world of London high society. And not only that, but once the Earl Grosvenor, his friend, realized what was happening, he actually intercepted all the letters between his wife and his wife's lover, the Duke of Cumberland. And before the inevitable trial took place. In fact, it's a civil lawsuit between the Earl Grosvenor and the Duke of Cumberland. The Earl leaked all these letters into the press so that in anticipation of the trial, the reading public could read each one. One a day they were published for several weeks before the trial. And so they provided, at one level, a tremendously good entertainment for the reading public, but also at another level, a criticism of the royal family, which the king himself was powerless to stop.
Hmm. So how did all this affect the G-P?
I think that George III was left as the Prince of Wales at a very young age. His own father, the father of all the people that I write about in the book, died when George was 12 years old, so when his oldest son was 12 years old. And he left him very, very explicitly with the charge not only of his kingdom, not only of his colonies, but also of his younger brothers and sisters. And in fact, before he died, not knowing he was going to die, but perhaps with some kind of premonition of his own ill health, Prince Frederick, George III's father, left him a paper in which he laid out, he called it, "Instructions for My Son George, Drawn by Myself for His Good and That of My Family." He laid out all his son's duties in this paper. And one of the things he wrote in this paper, he says that you must love your younger children next to the older born, and in the same way you will love your other countries next to England. Mm-hmm. So what he does there is that he explicitly coupled the colonies, that is the other countries, with the duties that his son had towards his siblings. He made it absolutely clear that George must act as the father, not only of his nation and his colonies, but also his brothers and sisters. What that meant for this very viscerally emotional young man as he was growing up, that he had this tremendous burden of responsibility. And he was trained by his tutor, Lord Bute, to think of his nation morally, to want to bring the nation to virtue, and of course his colonies, and of course his brothers and sisters, so that when they began to stray off the path, whether it was the colonies or the country or his siblings, the king became extremely upset and very often very angry, and he found it very, very difficult to control himself. So that what you see there, I think, is exactly what I was talking about at the beginning, which is that the way in which public life and private life were really set on a collision course, because inevitably people are going to start behaving badly. Yeah. And they did.
Yeah. Well, they behaved badly in part because, to put it succinctly, they were looking for love.
They were looking for love and...
In all the wrong places.
In all the wrong places. And they were looking, I think, that the way that Northern European Protestant families arranged their dynastic affairs and had done since the Reformation was that traditionally the princesses would be sent overseas to marry Protestant princes, and the princes would remain at home waiting for their suitable Protestant Northern European brides. However, George III and his brothers and sisters were brought up at a time when this kind of dynastic arrangement was, at least for the aristocracy, actually breaking down. So that ideas about the importance of affection in marriage, the importance of feeling and emotion were circulating and indeed were being taken up by the aristocracy. And a sense of a bit of leeway was creeping into aristocratic marriages, so that within limits, young women and young men were allowed to choose, or they were certainly allowed to refuse the people that their parents had chosen for them to marry. The royal family were the only family left, really, I think it's fair to say, in which these new kinds of emotional arrangements were not allowed to apply, so that they were stuck with a situation, the king's brothers, that they had to remain in England. They couldn't really leave the country. They didn't really have any kind of constitutional role. And they were supposed to wait for suitable German brides, which they didn't want to do. The combination of all those factors meant that they were looking for love, and they looked for it, yes, as you said, in all the wrong places.
Yeah. Now, George III, given his orders from his father, Prince Frederick Louis, he's in a role of big brother and surrogate father. He clearly has some sense of duty. His siblings, what were their thoughts about their duty as royalty?
I think that both of his sisters that I write about, Princess Augusta and then Caroline Matilda, who becomes the Queen of Denmark, really nobody asked them what their opinions were about anything at all. Had either of them been asked, I think it's probable that both of them, even at a young age, would have declined the husbands that they were offered.
Absolutely.
As for the brothers, what they tended to do was to profess their duty to their brother, and yet then in the end to go behind his back. So a kind of hypocrisy inevitably develops in these relationships, which, when the king discovers it, of course, makes him incandescently angry. So the stage is set for very poor family relationships. And in fact, by the time that the Americans revolt, he really has no good relationships with any of his brothers and sisters, because they have all done things which, put it mildly, he cannot approve of in his role as surrogate father and his role as monarch. So, in fact, it's in a way the fact that he rigidly follows the rules that his father lays down for him, and he imbibes them into his sense of who he is. It sets up a tragic outcome, obviously most particularly for his youngest sister, Caroline Matilda.
Yeah,
whose really terrible story is the centerpiece of this book.
Right. She has some sympathy from me, but also she was so reckless.
She was very reckless.
Maybe we should back up and talk about the marriages of George's sisters, Augusta and Caroline Matilda. Augusta, 1764, and Caroline Matilda, 1766. How were they arranged, and what did Britain gain by these marriages?
Yes, it's absolutely true to say that young princesses were not there simply to seal dynastic alliances, but they were there in order to further the interests of the powers to whom they belonged. So that Augusta and Caroline Matilda were really pawns in the great diplomatic game that's played out amongst European monarchies, and they would therefore be sold to the highest bidder. Isn't quite the way to put it, but. If you're the great power and you're sending over a princess, you want something in return. So they are, I think it's fair to say that they are traded. And Augusta is married to a German prince who, in return, will be sending troops to George III when he needs them. So that eventually he will be sending troops to fight in America. What the German princes have in abundance is manpower. What they absolutely lack is money. So what tends to happen is that an English princess may go one way, and in fact she may be floated on a fair amount of sterling. But coming the other way will be not only, of course, a strengthening of the alliance between Britain and these minor German powers, but also manpower when it's needed. So that the Dukes of Brunswick, in this case, and later of Hesse, will send troops to fight for George III when he asks for them. So that's the first dynastic trade, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
The second is done between Britain and Denmark, when Caroline Matilda is married, very much against her will, in fact, at the age of 15, to the very young, her first cousin, the very young King of Denmark, Christian VII. And again, money is going to go. Denmark is always looking for new sources of income. Money will go from Britain. But Denmark is much, much more important strategically than any of these small German principalities, and all the great powers, France, Britain, Russia, and Prussia, of course, that have interest in Northern Europe, all want to keep on good terms with Denmark for one very simple reason, is that Denmark controls the shipping that goes in and out of the Baltic. And all the major countries in Europe need what it is that the land around the Baltic can supply, the raw materials. So by marrying Caroline Matilda to the King of Denmark, the British Crown hoped to gain very favorable trading terms, basically. So she is parceled off to meet her husband, who she's been already married by proxy in 1766. And when she does arrive, it is very clear, as it has already been clear, in fact, to the British diplomats, although they keep it fairly quiet, that the King of Denmark has a very severe mental illness. And it's in that, I think, his profound indifference to the very, very young English princess that he has married that sort of sows the seeds for the disaster that follows in her life.
Hmm. Maybe you would give us here a little description about of Augusta and Caroline, Augusta being the older sister of George and Caroline, his younger sister.
Well, Augusta is, we don't have a lot of correspondence left from her. There is much more from Caroline Matilda, and because of what happened in her life, there is a very, very long series of interrogations with her conducted by Danish lawyers, and a whole series of letters to, from, and about her. We have a much clearer idea of her character, writing style, and so on. But Augusta seems to be to have been a rather boisterous, fun-loving, and interfering, busybodying kind of person. And George III is actually rather keen to get rid of her, partly because he thinks that she might start to meddle in British politics, and he's virulently hostile to any women having political opinions or meddling in politics at all. So he's rather keen to parcel her off to Brunswick, where she swaps rather the really growing magnificence of London for a very small palace and a very small and rather shabby German principality. And although she's married to heir to the Duke of Brunswick, who has been himself a hero in the war that's just ended in 1763, it doesn't take long before she realizes that he doesn't have much interest in her. He has his own interests in his country. He has his own mistress, by whom he has several children. And she has to look forward to a rather grim and dull life. In fact, she spends the next, my goodness, what is it, about 40 years trying to get back to England and make as many visits as she possibly can. And in fact, she does end her life in Britain, but very sadly, in a way, by that time, she's become so Germanified that she can't really fit in when she finally comes back at the end of her life to London.
Mm. And Caroline?
Caroline Matilda, a very, very much more complex, I think, intelligent, sophisticated character. She seems to have been much better educated than Augusta. She speaks several languages fluently before she goes to Denmark, and she is like her mother. Her mother, Princess Augusta. She is extremely determined character, and her anger at being sent away at the age of 15 to Denmark. The first manifestation of it is that as soon as she passes the border into Denmark, when traditionally the princess has to be left alone, because obviously governments are very suspicious that if a lady-in-waiting comes, she might be planted there as a spy. So that there's a symbolic kind of handing over of these poor princesses when they arrive at the borders of their new countries. But, from that moment onwards, she refuses to speak any English at all. And she very self-consciously decides that she is going to become a Dane. And within months, she's fluently speaking what I know to be the fiendishly difficult Danish language. Mm. So I had to learn it myself in order to write this book. She is trying not only to immerse herself in court life, but to find ways in which she can develop some kind of political power. So from the very beginning, Caroline Matilda is interested in how she can have purchase on the forms of power that are available, at least within the court in Denmark. She clearly fails because her husband is totally uninterested in her and basically sidelines her. And also, it's a crucial fact, that he is totally uninterested in running his own country. He has a visceral dislike of the idea of being a monarch at all. It's not until she finds a way of gaining power and control over the king that she begins to fulfill her own ambition of having some kind of power within the country. Mm. I hope that your listeners will read the story for themselves, but basically the way she does it is to start a passionate affair, very passionate on her side, with her husband's doctor, who is a radical young German doctor who himself is extremely interested in political power. And Denmark being an absolute monarchy, if you can get control of the king, who embodies the state, you can also get control of the country. And between the two of them, that is exactly what they do.
Mm-hmm. A power couple.
Sorry?
A power couple.
Yes, they're as you say, reckless, and they have very strong, very advanced, radical ideas. And they assume that the people of Denmark will want to take advantage of the reforms that they're going to bring them. And they really fail, I think, probably, to understand the way in which first courts work and then the country that they are beginning to govern actually works. They, of course, as anyone who carries out a coup makes enemies, and they certainly do. And that, in the end, is what their downfall is.
Yeah.
But before they themselves are arrested, they do, in absolutely short order, in the space of less than 2 years, bring a whole series of what we would call radical enlightenment ideas to Denmark, both in the political and in the private sphere. So basically, they take over the country and the king. Something that, of course, alarms George III back in London very greatly.
The reforms that they were interested in seeing take hold in the Danish court and in Denmark, did any of them take hold after this tragedy?
I think that the Danish historians tend to like to see the history of their wonderful country as a gradual move towards the social democracy that they have today. Clearly one of the things that they emphasize and that does seem to have happened is that the ideas that come with Struensee, the German doctor, and with the associates that he gathers around him do to some extent percolate down into the Danish court and into the first levels of government, and that therefore some of those ideas can be seen to be continuity over time, so that some of them, yes, I think probably do survive, but when they are ousted, Struensee, Caroline Matilda, then the government that comes in absolutely immediately reverses almost all the decrees and reforms that they have put in place. However, Caroline Matilda's son himself stages a coup in Denmark when he's only 16 years old, and he has been brought up under the principles of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and he then begins gradually to reinstate some of those more radical ideas. Although there is obviously the pendulum swings back again after Caroline Matilda is exiled, then I think that there is obviously a gradual move towards political reform in Denmark, but it was very violent. The swings to either side were very violent while they were going on.
Stella Tillyard is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's a historian, and she is the author, most recently, of A Royal Affair, George III and His Scandalous siblings. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions, comments for our guest, Stella Tilliard. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. George III's feelings about women and politics, do they stretch back to how his father was treated by the father's mother, George III's grandmother, Caroline?
I think that George III develops this idea that women should never be allowed to meddle in politics. You must make a separation between your domestic life and your life as the head of state. Of course, a distinction which he totally fails to actually uphold in his own dealings with his brothers and sisters, and indeed with his colonists. I think that probably goes back, in fact, well, I think there are two things that happen to George III. The first is that he falls in love when he's a young man with Sarah Lennox. It's a story that I wrote about in Aristocrats, which is the story of the four Lennox sisters. And he falls passionately in love with this beautiful, vivacious, intelligent girl. And he's forbidden from marrying her because she's a British subject and her family is very politically involved. As a kind of backlash against that, he really determines that he must never allow himself, I think, to be swayed again by that kind of passion. And the other thing that happens is that his tutor, Lord Bute, has been training him who doesn't want anyone to have influence on the king except for himself. Therefore, it has a great interest in suggesting to the young George III that women should be kept out of politics. What he does, he makes him write a series of essays on the history of France, which are designed to show that if the king has a mistress, for instance, the whole nation can kind of fall apart. And George III, I think he takes the combination of those two things makes him very, very, very wary about allowing a feminine influence, I think he would have probably, the way that he would probably have put it, on his judgment. So he wants to actually make a distance himself. After Sarah Lennox, he's desperate to make a distance between himself and any women who might be able to influence him, including his wife. So he doesn't discuss that kind of thing at home. But, of course, that makes him very, very... It makes him, sadly, the more isolated when things that do stir his emotions or domestic difficulties actually come up. So I think a very, very tempestuous, a much more emotionally visceral man than really we've hitherto seen or thought of George III as. And I think one of the things I try to do in all my work is to think about the way in which actually emotion and feeling is a tremendously important part of history, and it's also a very difficult part of history to write in and for us now to appreciate and feel.
Oh. I've got a listener I want to get to momentarily here. Before I take that call, though, do historians often look at sibling relationships?
No, I think it's very rare, and I think it's very rare that biographers do it either. It's something I have three siblings myself, and it never occurred to me when I was writing Aristocrats, which is about four sisters, that perhaps I was drawn to such a story because I'd have two sisters myself. And in fact, I wrote the whole thing probably a couple of years later. Someone said to me, do you think that's one reason why you're interested in that story? And it had never, ever occurred to me, but, which sounds absurd. But I think that led me to a sense or to wish to explore the importance of this relationship, which is a tremendously important relationship in people's lives. I think the reason why it tends to be ignored is because families traditionally have been seen to go down through generations rather than side by side. Then when biography fell under the influence of Freud, already biography had been seen to be our biographies, our lives, to be rooted in childhood. That goes back right into the 18th century tradition of biography. But once, I think, Freudian psychoanalysis comes along, that seems to really cement that, so that the sense that the most important relationships we have are those with our parents has filtered through very, very strongly into the writing biography, and also, I think, into the writing of history, so that these crucial relationships that we have, which are actually the horizontal ones, seem to be very little explored. So I found myself drawn to it again, yes.
Yeah. In this case, it's so critical because George III, he's 12 when his father dies, and there are so many siblings. And I think it's my observation that in larger families, in families with many brothers and sisters, that brothers and sisters raise one another as much as the parents raise them.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, of course, they were his family. Mm. His mother was a dominant force, but she died, in fact, relatively young. And that's and this happens to all of us. In fact, that when the generations pass or pass down to the next one, our most lasting relationships are those horizontal ones, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yes, I think there's so much more to be explored.
Let's take that call now. A listener waiting for us in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Thank you for this interview. It's fascinating. Forgive a colonial for not knowing the direct dynastic sequence, but apparently if you took Kings George first, second, third, and fourth, it's not all father to son, which I didn't realize.
That's right. There's one gap in there.
Okay.
Yes.
let's take the attitudes that have formed King George III and move them into politics with this comment from Stanley Weinbaum in his book Iron Tears. I don't know if you've read it.
No.
It's supposedly the British view of the American Revolution, but written by an American, in which he suggested that the real driving force for keeping the forces of Great Britain involved in the American Revolutionary War was the king himself above all others. Do you agree with that? And if so, what in your mind might have led the king to be so tenacious?
Well, I think that his observation is has some real importance and truth is that British historians over the last, I would say, 100 years have tended to downplay the role of George III, and when we talk about the British side, and talk about all the other political forces which prompted the country into war and then kept it there. I myself, having read all the letters of George III through the American War, the way in which he leans on the ministers, while I would say that it is absolutely, the king is significant only insofar as he can influence the British prime minister and government in their policy, he has no, obviously the king can't do anything about the motivations and strengths of the American colonists and rebels. So that actually the most important thing, and the thing that keeps the war going so long, is the determination of the Americans to win. And that is, I think, something which is absolutely inevitable, and nothing was going to stop it. It didn't matter what the British government or the king did. It was a political, social, and economic revolution which was unstoppable.
In Britain?
In the United States, in what became the United States. So the Britain was, what I'm saying is that the king couldn't do anything about the American Revolution. The American Revolution was inevitable, and it was going to be won, as indeed opponents of the war in Britain said at the very beginning.
But he didn't want to live.
But I do believe that the way that the king saw his colonists and America as the jewel and the crown of the colonies does certainly, it was a reflection of the way he saw his family. He saw the colonists as his children and his subjects, and he treated them as rebellious children that had to be brought to, they had to be whipped around and into shape to show their duty to the mother country. And all the language which he uses about the American colonists is the language that a father might use about a son who's being rebellious and trying to get away.
Thank you.
And the really, really interesting thing was there's this wonderful document in the Huntingdon Library, which is the King's, George III's annotations of the draft, the final draft document granting America independence. When it comes to the word independence, he crosses it out, and over the top of it he writes separation. And you think of that, and you think, that is a word which has been taken from the language of the family. And A, it shows he never agrees, really, but B, that the way he thinks about it is as part of his family. So, yes, I think that's absolutely right and an important observation, one we ought to think more about.
Mm.
So thank you for raising that.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. The struggles George had internally between head and heart and the way he viewed the world, do you think it played any role in his decline, in the deliriums that he suffered?
I think that it seems to be the case that although the king's madness is a physical illness, that as in many of these cases, a traumatic event can actually trigger them. So that I would be loath to say that there was no relationship between traumatic events and his episodes of madness. But it's as far as we know, and medical evidence does suggest that what he has is something called porphyria, which is a physical illness which leads to delirium and madness. But I think our understanding of medicine now is that there very often is a relationship between these two things.
Yeah, all that stress.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And certainly, I think all the stress of the quarrels with his siblings, the death of his sister Caroline Matilda in 1775, all that builds up to when the war breaks out in 1776. It all comes crashing out of him, and he has a sense that he articulates that he won't let this one get away.
Mm-hmm.
And of course it does, and this very, very tragic, sad document, which is his statement of abdication that he writes in 1782, I think it is, which he never delivers to Parliament, but he writes a statement where he says, I'm going to abdicate. And that is a sense that he feels of total personal failure in his family, in the war in America, and himself as a monarch. And he's obviously persuaded or thinks better of abdicating. But yes, it's the 10 years between 1772 and, say, 1782 were unbearably stressful for him, I think.
Yeah.
And the American War sees the playing out of that.
When you set out, did you have any sense of the scope of the drama, the emotion that you would uncover as you began pulling together the portrait of this family for this horizontal biography?
I don't think I did. I really had no idea what I was going to find in the archives in Copenhagen in Denmark. So that story, although it's a very famous story in the history of Denmark, hadn't really, again, been told very much from the British side, so that I was unaware of exactly the level of brutality, if you like. Really, that was, I think, the thing that shocked me most of all in the Danish story. And actually, the other thing that crept up on me, I mean, I had started this book thinking, I really don't want to write about George III. I'm not a strong monarchist myself. I'm very interested in this relationship between public and private life, in sibling relations, and how this all plays out in the age of celebrity and in the public sphere. Gradually, as I read more and more about George III and read his letters, I can't say I came to like him. But I did come to, in some degree, feel with him, I think, just the impossibility of the task. It was a hopeless job that he was given.
Yeah.
He was never going to be able to maintain the American colonies. He was never going to be able to control his sisters, or indeed his brothers and sisters, or indeed his own children, of course, who caused him also a lot of agony and I didn't anticipate that kind of not identification, but I think some degree of sympathy. Yes.
Yeah. Poor George. And one quick last question, and I have to ask you to be brief. How does Georgian celebrity compare with the celebrity today's royal family has to contend with?
Well, you know, I think it's really incredibly similar. There's nothing that they could do in the 18th century. Like, there's nothing that modern celebrities do today that I haven't found a parallel with in the 18th century. You know, hijinks, disgraceful behavior, publicizing, retreats to regain your character, all these things. These things are all already there. I would absolutely urge your listeners to read some of the things that went on in the 18th century. And one of the things, although it's not a parallel I ever make, I don't need to in my book, is that every time you read one of the episodes, you just think, this could have been today.
Yep. It's a very, very fascinating story. Stella Tilliard, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
It's really been my pleasure. Thank you.
Stella Tilliard is the author of A Royal Affair, George III and His Scandalous Siblings. The book is published by Random House. She's also the author of the book Aristocrats, Caroline, Emily, Louisa, and Sarah Lennox, 1740 to 1832.